Hey everyone, welcome back to Loyalty Unlocked. As always, I'm here with Mark Sage. So, Mark, today's episode is all about that really tricky balance between making things easy, like almost too easy, and keeping members genuinely engaged. It's something we've touched on before when we discussed the concept of flow and the need to hold the line to keep members engaged by keeping them in flow. This time, though, we're going deep on what happens when price and margin get in the way of flow.
You know, the funny thing is, price seems so simple on the surface, right? But as I've seen both professionally and as a customer myself, it's actually incredibly loaded. Let's take Tesco and Aldi back in 2015, for instance. For ages, I shopped at Tesco, super loyal. But then Aldi moved in with its, well, ridiculously sharp prices on daily essentials. Suddenly, Tesco was demoted to just my top-up store. I mean, technically, I wasn't lost as a customer, but the share of wallet just fell off a cliff.
And that's the kicker, right? Because Tesco reacted and tried to compete even more aggressively on price. But the thing is, when you go full price war, you sometimes end up devaluing your own loyalty rewards, which is basically, cutting off your own nose to spite your face. Sorry, that's a bit harsh, but you get what I mean.
No, that's exactly it. That move. Tesco started funding shelf price cuts by devaluing what you actually got from their loyalty program. It's classic short-term win, long-term problem. Suddenly, my loyalty flow was totally broken. I started splitting my shopping. Aldi for most stuff. Tesco. Only. For what I couldn't get elsewhere. Price pulls you in quick. But it doesn't build that sticky connection we always talk about.
So, I guess the thing is, price is kind of a double-edged sword. Like, sure, it gets you conversions and you fill the store, but the relationship? It's gone. And, Mark, didn't we talk in a past episode about how making things too easy, like discounting everything or handing out points just for showing up, actually backfires?
Absolutely. We covered this research in a previous episode, and what they found still blows my mind. You'd think a lower hurdle, make it easy, right, would keep people engaged longer. But it doesn't. When rewards are too easy to get, participation actually collapses. Repurchase rates drop from more than 50% down to 11%, because I suppose people just disengage. There's no challenge, nothing to strive for. The program just turns into a discount. And when that happens, people churn out even faster.
It's so counterintuitive, right? I always think, if it's easier, people will love it. But actually, if it's too easy, it stops feeling special. There's no point to the game anymore.
Exactly. And that's really the paradox. Loyalty works best when there's a bit of a game, a bit of a challenge, but it's also got to be winnable. Too hard, people give up. Too easy, they get bored and move on. It's about keeping that sweet spot. And price, not surprisingly, can totally mess with that flow if you're not careful.
Yeah, and it's not just price that can get in the way. Sometimes the actual rules of a program accidentally break the whole experience. I'm thinking about airline fare classes. Like, you book a cheaper ticket and suddenly the points just, poof, disappear, right?
That's such a good example. When I flew from Hong Kong to London with Cathay, I realized halfway through booking that I was in this weird loyalty paradox. Same plane, same seat, same dinner tray. And yet three completely different prices, depending on how fast I wanted to earn points.
You mean those light, essential, and flex fares?
That's the one. The light fare was about 7,300, essential around 8,000, and flex roughly 9,000 Hong Kong dollars. Nothing changed physically, no extra leg room, no champagne, but the loyalty math changed dramatically. If I picked the cheapest fare, I'd earn 1,800 Asia miles and 18 status points. Go one tier up, and I'd get 2,800 miles and 28 status points. Top tier, 3,800 miles and 38 status points.
So the miles double, but the seat doesn't move?
Yep, you're paying nearly $1,700 more for the same experience. And here's the kicker. When you do the math, you're effectively buying those extra miles at around 75 to 90 cents each, when Cathay actually sells them directly for about 30.
So it's a terrible deal on miles?
On the miles, yes, but the trap and the genius is the status points. You can't buy those anywhere. They're the gatekeepers. They decide if you're silver, gold, or diamond. So Cathay's not really selling you comfort. they're selling you acceleration. The light fare costs about $400 per status point. Flex brings that down to roughly half the cost per status point for the same seat.
So you're not buying a flight, you're buying progress.
Exactly. It's loyalty as velocity. They've turned fare classes into a kind of status shop. You can't purchase the trophy, but you can pay to level up faster, like buying XP boosts in a video game.
That's wild. It means the program isn't rewarding my travel behavior. It's rewarding how I play the system.
Right, it stops being about where you fly and starts being about how you optimize the rules. This is fine for business travelers where there is likely less scrutiny from finance. You bought the fare class you're allowed, so all good. What's missing from your expense receipt is the extra $2,000 you paid for that status. The challenge, though, is that for families or leisure travelers, that extra $2,000 doesn't buy real benefit. Just a faster climb on a leaderboard that resets every year. So progression is slower, loyalty is weaker, and flow falls away.
Loyalty just becomes another layer of yield management. Only this time, the yield is emotional.
Very true. They're monetizing aspiration. You pay more cash today for a feeling of progress tomorrow. It's rational for the airline, because the cost of those points is almost nothing, but emotionally expensive for the customer.
It's kind of brilliant, and kind of manipulative.
That's the perfect summary. Loyalty used to reward your choices. Now it monetizes your motivation. And the only real upgrade left is psychological.
So next time I see those fare classes, I'll just imagine a buy now button that says, purchase faster status.
Exactly. And once you see it that way, you can't unsee it. Each booking just turns into math. You stop playing for fun. You're just calculating value, and it becomes mechanical. No magic left at all.
Oh, totally. Another one that stresses me out is channel exclusions, you know? Like when hotels only reward you if you book direct and not through, say, an OTA. I mean, sometimes you have no choice. It's like you're being punished for doing what works for you, and seemingly works for them given they list there. And then it feels like the brand just doesn't care about your loyalty at all.
I don't think they do. They don't seem to see a customer, and instead just see a booking. I've had friends book with Marriott through an OTA, just because it was easier with their company platform, only to show up and find out, sorry, no points for you. It's not only a loss of points, it's a loss of feeling recognized. That I see you from the brand is just gone. And it doesn't nudge you into better behavior. It makes you check out mentally. Even though they had booked Marriott multiple times, that frequency wasn't recognized because they used a Marriott channel that Marriott didn't like.
And hey, remember when American Airlines almost tried to do that? Restricting AAdvantage points based on where you booked? I think their CEO actually said it would just confuse and frustrate the end customer. I mean, if a CEO is saying this is a terrible idea, maybe it's really a terrible idea.
Yeah, exactly. They reversed course in the end, because the backlash was immediate. Forcing customers into a more profitable behavior shouldn't mean shutting down their options. It should be about, well, signposting where the extra value is, not gatekeeping it.
It's funny, though, because someone inside the business is choosing to drive sales through the OTA. That's a distribution decision, right? But loyalty doesn't seem to have a seat at that table.
I feel like distribution and loyalty often operate like two different countries sharing the same passport. Distribution teams think in terms of volume, margin, and share of channel. Their KPI is fill the plane or fill the rooms. Loyalty teams think in terms of recognition, retention, and customer lifetime value. So you end up with this internal contradiction. One team is literally paying a commission to push bookings through a third party, while another team is penalizing those same customers for using that channel.
So it's the brand competing with itself.
Exactly. And the customer just feels the chaos. From their point of view, they did what the company's marketing encouraged, book where it's easiest, and loyalty then says, wrong door, no points.
Which is crazy, because both teams are trying to grow the same number, revenue.
It is. But this is because companies focus on product value, not customer value. They're trying to maximize the yield from that flight seat or that hotel room, not maximize the lifetime value of the person in it. It's subtle. But if you looked at customer yield management instead of product, you'd make very different decisions. You might accept lower profit on that one booking if it deepens the relationship, if it makes that person want to come back.
So instead of yield managing the seat, you'd yield manage the person.
In a sense, yes. Right now, most loyalty sits on top of yield management. It rewards the outcome of a sale. But in a customer-led model, loyalty informs yield management. It helps decide which customers you value more, not which seats you sell better. And it gets even trickier on the redemption side. Sometimes when you make it too easy, you actually kill engagement. Take Nectar at Sainsbury's. When they introduced instant redemptions at the till, participation flattened. The program lost its pull because there was no effort, no anticipation, no reason for a next visit.
So it's not about being complicated for the sake of it, but about keeping just enough challenge and feeling of progress. If the rules are too mechanical or too punitive, flow breaks.
True. The best programs balance friction and flow. Easy enough to feel fair, hard enough to feel worth it. Once you see loyalty as a game of progress rather than points, you start designing for psychology, not just yield.
Which, ironically, is exactly what Cathay are doing, just flipped the other way round.
Right. They've designed the psychology to serve the product yield, not the customer. The structure is brilliant. Progress, acceleration, status. But the motivation points upward, not inward. That's the fine line every loyalty designer walks. You can build a game that makes people want to come back, or one that makes them pay to move forward.
So the question isn't whether loyalty should feel like a game, it's whether you're the player or the product.
Love that. And it's where every program either wins loyalty or loses it. As being the player or being played has a direct impact on flow.
And speaking of systems that depend on balance, let's pivot into one of my favorite topics, coalition loyalty. I know, Mark, you've got a ton of firsthand stories from U Rewards and stuff, but like, let's talk about why trying to let everyone do their own thing, like partners asking for their own app features, actually risks breaking the whole system.
Oh yeah. This comes up so often in coalitions. Partners argue, well, our customer already has our app. Why not just let them earn or burn directly in our space? On paper, it sounds logical, but it's actually a subtle way of eroding engagement. Every time a member does something in a partner's app, they're not in the coalition app, so the ecosystem as a whole becomes weaker. And in reality, those using the partner app are usually your high loyal customers already.
So it's like you end up cannibalizing yourself. The more you push them into siloed experiences, the less they see the network benefits. And honestly, your high loyals start missing out too, because they're locked into a narrow lane instead of opening up bigger rewards or new partners.
Completely. And there's this fascinating counterexample in the market, AB InBev's Bees program. They expanded the app to include not only their own brands, but also third-party products. It actually gave retailers a real reason to open it more, which meant more exposure and more sales for everyone, including AB InBev. When you keep the ecosystem unified, you build momentum for all, not just one player.
That's such a great point. And you know, sometimes you can protect recognition without diluting the specialness. Take your old DFS program, for example. Weren't there luxury brands that didn't allow points, yet you still managed to find a way to recognize those spends for status?
Exactly. We couldn't always award points based on how some brands set their rules, but we could still count that spend towards tier progression. The customer sees they're moving up, even if points weren't available. That kept people engaged, it kept their flow intact, while respecting partner restrictions. It's about keeping the underlying psychology of progress and recognition going, even if the currency changes.
And, you know, designing those kinds of mechanics just feels like walking a tightrope sometimes. You can't just say yes to every partner who wants something easier, otherwise no one gets the true network value. Kind of like, you have to see the bigger picture.
Yep. The easy road is to let each brand build their own little walled garden. But every time you do, you lose another reason for members to play in the wider ecosystem. It's always tempting to make separate recognition easier for a big partner, but as a loyalty leader, you've got to hold the line and keep the system working for everyone.
So that actually brings us to the real heart of it, which is the role of the loyalty leader. It's making the hard calls, right? Not just taking every request as gospel, but thinking, does this help keep our members in flow? Or does it break the rhythm?
Yeah, this is where order maker, not order taker, really means something. I've had so many meetings where a partner or exec wants to make the program a little easier, or just add this quick feature. But sometimes the best thing for the program is to gently say no, or at least push back and ask, how does this affect the bigger picture?
It's kind of funny, because on paper it might look like you're just being difficult. But what you're actually doing is protecting the experience. You're making sure people stay challenged, motivated, but not thrown off balance. That's, I guess, why you have to signpost value. Show customers what's possible instead of blocking the path or handing out everything with no effort required.
It's about creating momentum, not roadblocks, and definitely not just opening floodgates. I think about it like this. True loyalty design means looking at every rule, every mechanic, and asking, does this keep the right tension between skill and challenge? Are we providing enough recognition, enough reward, and still letting them play? Or have we just turned it all into a transaction? I keep coming back to what we said at the start. Holding the line means keeping members in flow. Sometimes you have to resist the easy answers to do what's right for the long run.
That's such a good wrap-up, Mark. Keeping challenge, recognition, and reward in harmony is what makes loyalty really work, which isn't always easy, but it's definitely worth it. Anyway, thanks for hanging out and sharing your stories. I always learn a ton.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for tuning in to Loyalty Unlocked. If you enjoyed today's conversation, hit follow or subscribe. It helps more people find us and keeps the series going. We've got more coming up next time on the psychology, tech, and big ideas shaping how loyalty really works. See you soon.
Bye, Mark. See you next time, everyone.